As you may gather, I'm not in the best of shape at the moment. I got a chest x-ray and it turns out that it is not pneumonia, which is a good thing because pneumonia is no fun, especially recovering from it, which is the really bad part when you end up coughing your lungs out for 2 weeks, which I've done. However, I'm not going to be talking very loudly, and I may or may not be able to talk all of the time, but we'll see. I did want to remind you, it occurred to me, we hadn't discussed recently, the fact that there is one assignment other than attending class and taking exams and things, and that no one's done it yet. So I'd like to have that done reasonably close to the time we discuss the relevant body of law. So if you're going to do a case that's on tort law, you should be planning to do it reasonably shortly. If you're doing one on contractor family law, you should plan to do it about yesterday, but Thursday would be fine, and maybe even next Tuesday, and so forth. So you should be thinking about those cases. And what you're basically supposed to do is imagine that you're arguing the case in the Seventh Circuit before Judge Posner, and you want to win the case for whichever side you prefer. So you want to make law and econ, correct law and econ arguments for why your side should win, basically. And the only real restriction is that it should not be a case where you can get those arguments from what I've written or what Posner has written. It's got to be your own. Any questions on that? All right. Three different ways of looking at tort law, all of which are to some extent relevant to trying to make sense out of it. One of the things which complicates the analysis of the law is that often the same body of law can be seen as accomplishing several different things, and they aren't always consistent with each other. One can see tort law as a Pigouvian tax. You can read it. I'm not going to read it to you. Yeah. You can also see it as a bounty to law enforcers. If you think of our tort system as really sort of like a privately prosecuted criminal system, which has existed in the past. 18th century England, for example, it was the victim who normally prosecuted the criminal. So you can say, well, in the tort system, how do we get torts punished? If we think of it as punishment, we give somebody an incentive to bring the person to court and prove he done it. How do we do that? The person gets a bounty. What's the bounty? It's the damage payment. And of course, tort is sometimes thought of as insurance. Your loss is being less made good. Why might insuring you be a bad thing? Why might it be better if the payment didn't go to the victim? In terms of ideas we looked at before.
For the victim.
Suppose instead of having the payment go to the victim, the tortfeasor has to hand over a pile of cash and we burn it. Precisely. It's the old Coasean point about double causation. And it's really the same as our insurance point about moral hazard. That when you're insured, you take fewer precautions. So, right. You may be able to give a better legal definition than I can, but I think this sums up, from the law and econ standpoint, what a tort is. It's got to be a wrongful act. I might take an act that you didn't like, such as bidding against you for a house, or persuading the woman you want to marry me instead. And you can think it imposes costs on you, but nonetheless, it's not considered wrongful under our system. Generally, a tort has got to impose costs on somebody, external costs. And in the case of competition, there is a long-standing legal doctrine that is not a tort, and the economist's explanation of that is that the externality is only a pecuniary externality, meaning that someone is worse off, but a different external person is better off by the same amount, because my competitor is worse off because he can't charge as much for his product, but then his customers are better off by the same amount. There are lots of wrongful acts that impose externalities that we all ignore, and certainly lots of non-wrongful acts that impose externalities we will ignore. And there's even a legal doctrine, as you may know, de minimis non curat lex. The law doesn't concern itself with trifles. So it's got to be large enough so it's worth using the legal system to deal with. And part of the economist's distinction, at least between tort law and criminal law, the only part, is the distinction between a liability rule and a property rule. And that a liability rule says I impose a cost on you. We deal by that by trying to make me reimburse you for the cost. A property rule says I impose a cost on you. We deal with that by having me locked up. Why do we do that? So that instead of imposing the cost on you, I will get your consent in advance, meaning hand treat it through property rather than through liability. All right? So if you think of my example, if, as far as I know, I am legally entitled to resign my present position, I think any time, certainly at the end of the year, which I think would be consistent with the usual professional norms. I would like to believe that the law school would be much worse off if I left, although that may be self-flattering. Nonetheless, he can't sue me for it. And the basic grounds for his not being able to sue me from the economist's standpoint is that if I'm really worth that much to him, he ought to be willing to make me an offer that I'm willing to accept. Now, one could turn it around. This is a legal system where people belong to themselves. You could imagine a slave society, of which there have been lots, and that's one where I don't get to quit. And we could apply the same analysis. Why don't I get to quit? Well, if not working for this employer is worth more to me than having me is worth to him, I ought to be willing to make him an offer to buy myself free, which he should accept. So you could imagine a property rule that did not have as one of its base rules, self-ownership, although our property rule does. Causation is one of those things. There are a lot of things which make less sense the more you think about them. And half of them, at least, is just because philosophers like to make the world complicated. But some of them, I think, are real. And in particular, that causation is the sort of thing which sounds much clearer when you start thinking about it than when you finish. And one of the concepts of causation that people sometimes like to use in the law and elsewhere is what's called but-for causation. When you say, I caused it, why? Because but for me, it would not have happened. And that runs into a number of different problems, and one of the ones I'm rather fond of is coincidental causation, which is an absolutely clear case both of but-for causation and of not being causation in the sense in which the law normally treats it. And so that's my example. My friend is walking down the street. I perfectly innocently stop him and ask him what kind of a day he's having and, you know, what colleges kids are getting are applying to. We chat for a couple of minutes. He walks down the street a little further, and a safe falls out of a third-story window and smushes him flat. And it's perfectly clear that if I hadn't stopped him to talk, he would have passed that point before. I'm assuming the safe was not aimed at him, so if it's just an accident. So if I had not stopped him to talk, he would have passed that point 3 minutes earlier and would have been fine. So I am clearly the but-for cause of his dying, and yet it would seem a little bizarre for his heirs to sue me for wrongful death on those grounds. Another one, which I'm also sort of fond of because of its sort of paradoxical nature, and one which, as we will see, corresponds to at least one real law case, although not quite as dramatic as the version I give, is the one where three men go hunting, and two of them think they see a deer, but the deer is, in fact, the third hunter, and one of them shoots him through the head and one through the heart. And the question is either of them a but-for cause of his death? And the answer is no, right? Since either bullet is sufficient, each of them can correctly claim, but for me, he would still be dead, therefore I'm not the but-for cause of his death. Right. And then finally, somewhat different kind of problem, but a real one in terms of trying to deal with things in the legal system, is probabilistic causation. My radiation leak raised your risk of cancer a little, so when you get cancer, did I cause it? Now, I should say, because I was just looking at a discussion of this online, I think it is dubious that Three Mile Island killed anybody in that sense. I gather, in fact, the radiation leak wasn't very large, and as you may know, one of the problems with a whole lot of this radiation stuff is that people often assume a linear relationship between radiation and various bad things such as birth defects and cancer. We know that assumption is false because people in Denver have a mile less atmosphere between them and space than we do. The result is that the cosmic ray background is substantially higher in Denver. There are also other people living in places which for one reason or another have a higher background radiation level, and we don't actually observe correspondingly higher levels of birth defects and cancer. So it seems at least likely that it's one of these relationships where there's a little effect at low levels and then it gets substantial at higher levels. I saw a piece a while ago from which, is, if I understood it correctly, it isn't even clear that Hiroshima and Nagasaki caused increases level of birth defects and cancer. Now, of course, in that case, one reason people didn't get cancer afterwards is they were dead, but there were some people who weren't dead. At least that study apparently didn't find an effect. But in any case, probabilistic causation is going to exist. How does the law handle it? If you just think of sort of ordinary black-letter law, if you can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that there's one chance in 10 that the reason you got cancer is my negligent radiation leak, do you have a case against me in tort law or not? Because?
You have to show more than 10% chance that there are different standards based on the
crime. Roughly speaking, you have to show a preponderance of the evidence.
Right, which is usually 50+.
So at least on black letter law, you're perfectly safe. That raises the question, if such issues are common, how might we deal with them? I think somebody was just, somewhere I just read about a case, it isn't the same thing, but it's a similar issue, and I think this was a criminal case in which it turned out that the person they arrested had an identical twin brother, and I think they had DNA evidence, but there was no way of proving which of the two twins the DNA was from, and I guess neither of them had an alibi, so although it was clear that one of the two had committed the crime, there was no way of knowing which, and so they couldn't convict either of them. And I think that was a real case, although it could easily have just been a story.
I was going to say that I think there's an exception to the probabilistic causation thing. I don't think that the standard for getting medical monitoring damages is 51%.
Huh, what's medical monitoring? Yeah.
What they'll do is, like, say that there's a toxic tort where you spill something in the environment, right, and people are fearful that there's, yep, an increased probability of cancer. Yep. The court may set aside, if the risk is less than 50.1%,
yep,
a lump fund to pay for people to go to a doctor,
right,
and get preemptive treatment.
Yep, but then you could plausibly argue that the probability is much more than 50% that the reason they had to go to the doctor was this toxic tort, even though going to the doctor involved a gamble where they might be wasting the defendant's money or might not. Yeah, it's an interesting case, though. Yeah, there's a different case I'll be discussing, a fairly prominent case, which involved a different kind of probabilistic causation where the probabilistic element was who was the party responsible. Let's go back to the coincidental causation problem. So the argument is clear, and how would you explain away the fact that we don't get to sue for coincidental causation?
Foreseeability.
Yeah, I think foreseeability is the legal doctrine. The economist's way of putting it is we want to give people the right incentive, and since I didn't know, there's no way of giving me an incentive to stop him when it will save his life and let him go on when that will save his life. You could imagine a case that goes the other way around where we say, all right, I'm liable when I make him die, but then I get a suitable reward when I save his life. But given the low probability of both, it doesn't sound worth it. It makes more sense to just say my liability is considering ex ante costs at the point when I took the action, not ex post. I assume that everybody's familiar with the ex ante ex post distinction between saying what is the cost in terms of the probabilities versus what's the cost in terms of how it came out. So that if you go to a slot machine and put in $1 and $20 comes out, and the question was, is that a good gamble? And the answer is ex ante, it was a bad gamble. Ex post, it was a good gamble. All right, it was not worth paying $1 for one chance in 100 of getting $20 or whatever it was, but it was worth paying $1 for the $20 you actually got. So that's a, in many contexts, a useful distinction.
Question?
So one of the issues we may want to think about, because it shows up in lots of places, is when the law charges me ex ante and when ex post lived. I think I discussed earlier the... Did I discuss with you the case of the Himalayan photographer?
Yeah.
So that's a case where the law thinks of it ex ante. We say, yes, it turned out that their carelessness with this film imposed a large cost, but given that they didn't know that was true of this film, they are only responsible for the precautions appropriate given the probabilistic situation. On the other hand, if you think about a car accident, when the accident happens, we don't say, well, look, it only happened because at the point when you were driving drunk, there happened to be somebody else out on the road who had to stop suddenly, and therefore, if you'd been sober, you would have avoided rear-ending him. But since you were drunk, you didn't. We say, well, you did a certain amount of damage. You're liable for it. So that's sort of an interesting question. But then the general approach on this, as I say, from the economist standpoint, is to think about the incentives that we give people in not driving drunk, in not having expensive cars, whatever things are the variable. And the problem we run into in many, many contexts, which makes life more difficult than it might otherwise be, is incentives on multiple margins. So quite often when you're thinking this through, you'll set up a toy situation where you, well, what we'll get to later is a situation where all collisions are between cars and tanks. Why do I do that? Because that way I can forget about the question of damage to the tank and only think through the damage to the car side of the problem. But to apply it to real law, you're obviously going to have to do both of those. And what's the right incentive for the case of stopping my friend to talk? And the answer is zero punishment, because I have no way of knowing whether stopping him is more likely to cost his life or save his life, neither of which is very likely. Redundant causation. If you actually sort of work through mathematically the logic of that problem, I think it's a correct statement that making me liable for half the value of his life when both bullets hit him really does give me too much of an incentive not to go hunting. Again, obviously it's a trivial incentive in that case, but we're just trying to think through the logic of it. And then, therefore, the rule which says that neither of us is liable is, from that standpoint, the right rule. On the other hand, the real case, as I say, which I forget the name of, but you may have studied it, was two fires where a building is burned down by a fire due to my negligence. I think one of the fires was along a railroad line, as I remember. And the question was, it was at least argued that it would have burned anyway. And so then the question is, am I liable? And there are a couple of problems with what I claim is the correct economic argument that you're not liable. One of them is that it's just possible that the two hunters actually had a reason to want the third hunter dead, and that they coordinated their activity in advance after reading my book, and they said to themselves, look, we're going to do this at exactly 10:03 and 15 seconds. We both pull the trigger, and then we'll get off scot-free. You get to marry his wife, and I happen to be his heir, and so we're happy. He's not happy. And so that's one problem. And the other problem is that at least in some of these cases, we aren't really worried about over-deterrence due to the fact that we aren't going to be able to adequately deter the ordinary case. So if we say, look, the single bullet case, you can't pay enough damages to really compensate him for getting dead. So therefore, if we follow the apparently correct rule and say you're only liable in the single bullet case, we're under deterring you. Since you didn't know the other hunter was shooting, we hope you didn't know the other hunter was shooting, therefore all we're doing is raising a little bit the effect of the damages when you're a single killer, and we'd like to do that. Well, anyway, and it's a little bit like the argument that I think I made in the past about attempted murder, that what we're doing is compensating for the fact that we can't fully punish you properly for real murders, and so we put some extra weight on the attempted case. All right. So here's my theory, and I don't know if it would work or not. You're closer to being lawyers than I am. Suppose I get together 10 people who all have or better, 100 people. 100 people who got cancer. And we sue the reactor owner. And we say, look, we don't know which of us got cancer due to your leak, but we're suing jointly as a, you know, association for the purpose, whatever, and we can show statistically that by a preponderance of the evidence, 9 of our 100 cancers are your, sorry, from 10 to 11%, I'm wrong, one of your, no, these are people who got cancer, right? So that's right. It's 1/11. So 9 of our 100 cancers on average are due to your radiation leak. So you owe the group of us compensation for 9 cancers, and we can divide it up to be like, was that going to fly legally or not? You may know. Or are there any analogous cases? Because I don't know if there are.
I can't think of any off the top of my head, although I'd suggest that it runs afoul of the 51% causation thing.
More than 51% causation. The question is causation of what?
Well, but causation to the individual person rather than.
Can't you have? I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. Can a group of people?
There was a class action that went about in courts where, I forget the specifics, but it was, I think, a drug case where it increased your chance of heart disease. And what they ended up doing, I think, was setting aside a certain amount of money across everybody, and if you happen to get it, you could get the money. But it was sort of a court-made decision where they definitely knew that it caused some, they just didn't know who it was going to affect.
Yeah.
So they set aside money, and if you later.
But was this a case like the DES case where the court was essentially inventing the law to fit it?
Yeah.
All right, because the one that I'd wondered on, there may well be that there are barriers to this, I just don't know, that if you imagine. I'm trying to imagine somehow an ordinary tort case where it's clear that your negligence hurt one of the two of hurt the property of either him or me, but we don't know which. That we saw two cars came smashing through our houses, one through my house and one through his house, went out the other side and then collided with each other. And it turns out that one of the cars was driven by a guy who had a heart attack, and that was why he wasn't under control. The other was driven by you. And I say, look, we don't know which of the two cars went through, whether your car went through my house or his house, so the two of us are going to say, well, the two of us together suffered these damages. We know half the damages were your fault, so we're suing. Can you do that legally or not? In what cases can parties join?
It just sounds like a case of joint and several liability where you have. I think it's different in that case because you have two discrete tortfeasors who you know.
No, but one of them isn't a tortfeasor. The guy with the heart attack isn't a tortfeasor. It's two victims that I want to join, not two tortfeasors. I want to know whether I can take the combined loss to two victims and sue for that combined loss rather than for the individual lottery. Well, and isn't that what a class action is really doing? Where is it? Well, if any of you feel like looking it up, I'm just curious as to whether this would actually work. Real case is DES, which I think was a terrible case on unrelated grounds, but diethyl stilbestrol, which was a drug whose purposes I now forget. But the drug was generously released into the public domain by the inventors because it looked like a useful drug. They weren't going to make any money off of it. The result was that lots of firms were producing it. The result was that when, long after it was produced and taken, it turned out to have a problem, and the problem was a second-generation problem. The problem was that if a woman took it when she was pregnant, there was some probability that her daughter, when she reached puberty, would have. I think it may have been a form of vaginal cancer or something like that, or anything. Something connected with the reproductive system, which is why it was when she reached puberty that the effect appeared. I think there was some dispute about whether you were talking about like 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000 or 1 in 100,000, about how much the probability went up, and I don't know what the evidence is. But the interesting legal problem is that with no records of who produced which dose, there was no way of saying this woman can sue this drug company. No drug company produced a majority or close to a majority, so there was no drug company for which you could say it was probably responsible. Now, that's aside from the issue of I think what's going on is that the particular effect, it was not that it became more likely, but that this was the only important cause of that particular medical problem, if I've got it right. I don't swear I do. So therefore, you could say, well, if she got it, we know the drug is responsible, but we don't know which company is responsible. And so the court assigned liability by market share. So it was essentially saying, and that looks a whole lot like my reactor case. I say it's an odd case. It's not, I think, ordinary established law. I don't know if there have been other cases since that followed it, but in which we say, all right, you sold 12% of the DES doses, 12% chance you're responsible, you owe her 12% of her damages. Now, as I say, I think, from what I understand of the case, that it should have been dismissed before that on foreseeability grounds, that if we ask about the incentives we're giving, that in order for this to have been prevented, they would have had to keep the drug off the market for something like 14 or 15 years until they could see how the children of the women who took it when pregnant turned out. And they would have had to test the drugs at the beginning of that period on something like 10 or 20 or 30,000 pregnant women, which probably means several hundred thousand people in general, because they couldn't know in advance that pregnant women were what the problem was. And it seems to me unreasonable to say that you will not use a drug until you've tested it on several hundred thousand people and waited 14 years to see if anything happens. So I think that foreseeability is sufficient grounds for throwing it out, but that's not the view of the court. And I'm not a lawyer. So let's think a little bit more about auto accidents. And to non-economists, it seems a little bit odd to talk about the efficient number of traffic accidents. You know, how many people do we want to die today? And the economist's reply is that depends how much it costs to keep them from dying. That life is valuable, but not infinitely valuable, and the world is, alas, full of trade-offs. If we really thought of reducing traffic accidents as our sole goal, well, banning cars would do it, at least that kind of traffic accident. My friend Gordon Tullock had some ingenious solutions to the problem of traffic accidents. His low-tech version was you equip every steering wheel with a dagger pointing at the driver. So if you have a traffic accident or even step on the brakes too hard, you get killed. And then his higher-tech version, using still off-the-shelf technology, we've got lots of surplus hand grenades after all, is that you insert in each car a hand grenade, wire it to the system that nowadays is used for airbags, and so when the airbag would have detonated, the hand grenade detonates instead. The result is that everybody knows that getting in an accident kills you, and the result is that everybody drives very, very, very carefully. Cuts down the number of accidents, almost only cuts down the number of deaths, even despite the increased number of deaths when accidents occur, and yet it doesn't seem like a good idea. Along these lines, there's a classic article by Sam Peltzman which dealt with the effect of auto safety requirements, so that there were a set of requirements that went in at one point, which I think included seat belts having to be available in cars, and I think some other modifications in the rules for car design. And it was asserted that these saved a certain number of lives per year. So how would you calculate it? Suppose we put in a bunch of changes in cars, and we may have had some statistics before that. How do we find out how many lives were saved by that change? Note that this kind of issue shows up all the time, that one of the standard things you get news stories on is there was one case, Florida repealed the requirement that people wear helmets when riding motorcycles. And then a few years later, there's a news story saying that the number of deaths of unhelmeted motorcycle riders had gone up a lot. Now that, if you think about it, is completely bogus, because that doesn't tell us whether the number of deaths went up a lot. It just tells us that when people died, now they were dying without helmets on. But even if you looked at the question of number of deaths, you would also want to ask things like, how did the number of people riding motorcycles change during that period of time? Maybe what you want is deaths per mile or something like that. And even then, if you imagine, say, that medical care was getting better or worse, better probably during that time. So how would you do this calculation? Any guess?
70 cars on the road from the original study and now.
Yep.
Factor that in.
Yep. You're getting closer to how you do it right, which is what Feltzman did. What the people who originally produced the figures did was to look at the death rate for accidents for cars that did not have this characteristic and cars that did. And they presumably could do that because, of course, they would, for a long period, there would be older cars that didn't have the new requirements. And they said, all right, your chance of dying in a car that doesn't have a seatbelt in it, which is, you didn't have to wear the seatbelt, but something that's allowing for the probability you would, is, let us say, 5% percentage points higher than one that does have a seatbelt, similar to the other things. How many accidents were there? If there were 50,000 accidents and chance of dying goes up to 5%, more than by 5% by 50,000 accidents. And the problem with this, as Peltzman pointed out from the economist's standpoint, is that it assumes that these safety improvements didn't affect the number of accidents. But given that all of these were improvements not on preventing accidents, it wasn't things like better brakes, these were all things that made you less likely to be killed if there was an accident, like seatbelts. What is the effect on the number of accidents of making cars safer to be in when there's an accident? Because? Very good, because the driver perfectly rationally, it's not that he wants to have an accident, he wants to get home faster. He doesn't want to have to sit, you know, to take a cab because he's taken a couple of drinks. You can think of lots of reasons why people trade off risks of accidents because other desirable things, and the safer the car is, the more willing you are to do that. There's a science fiction story by Larry Niven somewhere, which is sort of a spoof, but it's describing some future high-tech society where their flying cars are very, very, very safe and with sort of multiple layers of stuff, and somebody's car gets, I think, eaten by a giant bird or a giant flying creature on some planet, and he ends up suing because it was so uncomfortable being in that car for the 6 months before the flying creature rotted away, and therefore the safety things were able to get him out of the carcass and back home. But anyway... But in that world, of course, there'd be no reason to be careful. So, in any case, Peltzman's conclusion was that the improvements had reduced the number of deaths per accident by about the same percentage rate for which it had increased the number of accidents. So total number of deaths had stayed about the same. Doesn't tell you that it was a bad thing, of course, because maybe the advantage of getting home faster was worth the cost of those changes. It just tells you that the claim that it saved lives isn't true. So in any case, to get efficient accidents, that means we want people to take precautions only when the precautions save more in the expected cost of the accident than the precautions cost. And the way to get that to happen is for me to pay the costs of accidents I cause. And that's the same argument we've been running through. I mean, this should be very much old hat to you. We've been going through the same argument over and over again. That's Bagoo's argument. That's everybody's argument. If you want a decentralized system to work, you've got to make each actor bear the cost to receive the benefits of his own action. We start with the relatively easy case of a unicausal accident, meaning that unlike the usual Coasean situation, only one party affects the probability. So we'll assume that there are no precautions you could take which would affect the chance of you're a pedestrian, I'm a driver, and let's assume, contrary to fact, that nothing you do affects the chance of your being run over, or at least nothing you can do at any cost that you're willing to pay, and therefore it's only my actions that affect it. And consider the two sort of most common liability rules we're familiar with, strict and negligence. Which of them gives an efficient incentives in the case of unicausal accidents. Strict liability says that if you run me over, you're always responsible for the costs. Negligence liability says if you run me over, you're responsible for the costs if you did not take all cost-justified precautions. This is negligence as economists define it. It's not identical to how the courts define it, although there is the famous learned and, I think, rule. Something and, anyway, somebody famous who made the equivalent of this. Which of these leads to an efficient level of accidents?
Let's do the negligence model. Is the strict liability model, there's some degree less incentive for me to be super careful, because I know if somebody just like runs in front of my car, I have less control over.
The question first is not whether there is more or less incentive, but whether there's more nearly the right incentive. We don't want those hand grenades, right?
Right.
It's negligence because you have to take the, if you're driving the car, the precautions that you won't do anything. You take all the necessary precautions so you won't get in an accident. And then the person you might hit has to take the precautions himself.
He can't take any precautions. This is still unicausal. You're ahead of me. At the moment, we're taking the unicausal case. So he has no precautions to take.
So some people will be afraid of driving because their liability is too high and they can't control all the risks. So you'll have some people.
Why is that a bad thing?
I'm not saying that it is. Saying that there'll be some people.
Isn't not driving one more precaution?
Right. I mean, most people would argue that that's too much of an incentive.
Depends how much not driving. You're thinking of it if it's all or nothing. How about if not driving means that in those rare cases where I'm just sort of, yeah, well, you know, am I going to take an extra trip to the grocery store today, or am I going to figure the milk will last till tomorrow? In that case, I say, well, the extra trip to the grocery store, there's a 4-cent expected cost due to this damn strict liability rule, so I guess I won't take it. Right. And then that's the right precaution to take.
It's also the cost of the bill, yeah.
Of what? Yes, the question I'm asking, however, at the moment is not whether we get an efficient level of lawsuits or whether we get an efficient level of precaution. It's perfectly true that a full analysis has to think about the cost of enforcing the rules, which we'll get to a bit later. But under strict liability, who bears the cost of any decisions I make that affect the chance of my running into you? What? I do.
You bear it all.
That's right. Isn't that the right rule? If it's you, if I'm the only one who can affect it, because it's unicausal, isn't making me liable for all the costs exactly what Mr. Bagu would tell us to do?
Yeah, but that assumes that making... I know what you're getting at. I just can't... Right? It's not what I don't think we want to do.
Why? We do it for some things, after all.
Because... The best I can say is it's too much...
Why is it too much? Isn't it exactly right to say I bear the full cost of my actions?
Because it would...
Somebody else? I mean, keep trying to get you to talk because my voice is going to run out pretty soon.
Because some accidents will happen even if you take all the precautions.
Yep. So what?
So if some accidents are going to happen despite all the precautions you take, that even with the strict liability, you'll get too many accidents?
No, not too many.
Well,
some.
You'll get, with the strict liability, you're still getting some accidents.
Right.
It suggests... I want to say you're overpaying, but...
Maybe I'm overpaying, but am I over-deterring? Some of the payments serve no useful purpose, and if we start thinking about litigation costs, that might be relevant. But as long as we're only asking the question of my incentive to take precautions, those payments that I have no way of getting out of aren't going to affect my precautions.
Okay.
So none of you seem to believe that strict liability gives an efficient level, despite the fact that it looks like the precise Pigouvian rule, and you think negligence does. And I think both of them do. Under my simplified assumptions, under my unicausal, ignoring causal mitigation and so forth. Strict liability, I bear the full cost. Negligence, either I take all cost-justified precautions, which is what the result we want, or I don't. If I don't, I'm back in strict liability. I bear all the costs. If I'm going to bear all the costs, now it's worth my taking all cost-justified precautions. So my claim is I take exactly the same precautions under either of those rules as we've so far described. Make sense? No. Now I want to get to your point of my decision to drive. Because my claim is that it's a perfectly legitimate point, but it involves noticing one of the flaws in my model, one of the respects in which I'm simplifying. What kind of precautions will the negligence rule not make me take? What category of precautions will the negligence rule give me an inadequate incentive to take?
Not driving.
That's one example. Can you describe that as a more... And why won't it? Why won't it give me an incentive to not drive when I shouldn't drive? If not driving is a precaution, and if it was cost justified, then wasn't my driving negligent, even if I did it carefully? Shouldn't have gone to get that extra gallon of milk. What's different between my not getting my brakes checked and my deciding to drive when I shouldn't have driven? Why do you think of one of them as in a different category than the other?
Because we're not looking at all of the costs. We're looking at the cost of not driving. The cost of driving versus not driving is unclear because you don't know whether you're going to have an accident that one particular time.
No, but that's true of not getting your brakes checked. What's different about driving, not driving? And I'm going to claim it could apply to lots of other things as well. That's just one example.
I can't articulate it.
Yeah, you ought to read the chapter first then. The difference is that it is not a precaution that the court can observe and evaluate. That the court, in deciding whether you're negligent, is limited by what it knows about your activities and what it knows about which activities were or weren't cost justified. It might conceivably, probably can judge that driving after taking three drinks was negligent, but it's not in a position to judge how much driving it would have been optimal for you to make, and therefore it's going to ignore all of those precautions that are unobservable precautions. Of which activity levels and how much you drive is the sort of standard example, but not the only example. Does that make sense? The difference is really what... Imagine an omnipotent, omniscient court.
How is the court in any more of a position to say whether you should have gotten your brakes checked every, third month or fourth month or versus whether I drove today or tomorrow?
That is, they presumably can see that it was the failure of your brake that caused the accident to occur. And they can then say, all right, how frequently is it recommended that brakes be checked in order to prevent such failures? And so you were negligent, you haven't had it checked for 2 years and the brake failed. I agree that
versus
courts...
Versus saying that you drive all the time. Well, I mean, the same testimony...
They have no way of.
Should have been checked every 4 months. Is that you're driving all the time?
But how do they?
You should have been timed. You very easily could have combined your errands into one day.
That's going to require much more detailed information about your circumstances than the figures on brake failure. I agree that it's not a bright line distinction. Even the things they can judge negligence on, they're going to do it imperfectly. But I think it is useful. as a sort of a way of understanding the logic of the problem, to think in terms of the kind of precautions that they're in a position to observe and evaluate and the kinds that they're not. And that the implication here with regard to the unobservable precautions, does strict liability give the right result? Unobservable to the court, not unobservable to you, the driver. Haven't you just told, didn't we just get the answer when we were told that strict liability might decide, make you decide not to drive? Unobservable precaution.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to argue that it's observable. It might take more work to observe it, but presumably whoever's prosecuting you could, or whoever's suing you, could take the time to go to all the places that you do your errands and see on what day you do them and at what time and what your work schedule is, and they could determine that you should have done them all in one day, or you could cut down your amount of driving. I just don't think there's a right line distinction. I don't think there's even a line. I think it seems arbitrary to me.
Fine. What I'm saying is it is not a bright line distinction, but that there is a large enough difference in degree so that it's useful in thinking it through to imagine it as a complete difference in kind. So with regard to the unobservable precautions, does strict liability give you the right incentives or not? Just noticed that I forgot to plug in my computer, however, it'll last longer than this.
Our only goal is to have less accidents.
No, efficiently less. Our goal is to have the efficient level of accidents. Less accidents we can manage very easily. Gordon Tullock told us that. So if we make you strictly liable, will you take account of the chance of your running into somebody when you decide whether to drive any particular trip? Right. Now, how about negligence? Suppose that if everything the court can observe, you're taking the efficient level of precautions, then you aren't going to be liable. Now, is it in your interest to consider the precaution of not driving, assuming you're going to drive safely if you do drive?
We take all the benefit outweighs the cost to you. So, I mean, you wouldn't take into account the things that other people are doing. The things you can't observe, or things the court can't observe, is if you're doing everything that's observable, then you won't be liable.
That's right. So you now have no incentive to worry about the unobservable ones. So therefore, strict liability has the advantage in the unicausal case that it gives you an incentive to take an efficient level of both observable and unobservable precautions, whereas negligence gives you an incentive to take an efficient level of only observable precautions. Okay. Now, a further issue, which I've been skipping over until then, is the question of litigation costs. Strict liability gives you more cases. On the other hand, negligence gives you harder cases because you've got one more fact to establish. This goes to the point which I've just been making. You can read it through because my voice isn't going to hold up much longer. So if you think about the legal implications, there are certain cases for which we have strict liability, such as ultra-hazardous activities. And Posner's, I think, plausible explanation is that those are cases where we suspect that activity level is a really important precaution, that an important way of not injuring people when blowing up rocks with dynamite is not to blow up rocks with dynamite, even if you do it carefully. And that, therefore, since that's a case where that's an important precaution, we use strict liability instead of negligence. Now let's go to the realistic case. My voice isn't going to last much longer, so how about you ask questions as I go through this? Problem, provided we don't have to worry about the unobservable problem. said, I'm giving up. I will have the PowerPoints up on the web probably tonight. You are welcome to email me any questions. There's not a whole lot of point of view.